like typically when we say, oh, you have a lot of energy, it sounds positive, but there's so much energy built up in your body during a manic episode that you can't even sit still and you definitely can't sleep.
Welcome to the Brown Girl Podcast. This show was created to elevate the voices and perspectives of dual identity South Asians around the world. Here we have conversations on topics and issues that impact our community, as well as share the stories of personal successes and the struggles that often go unsaid. My name is Julie George, and I'm your host.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me today. This is episode 26, and today we are talking about mental health and specifically what it's like to live with bipolar disorder. This is such an important topic, especially in the South Asian community, and I'm so thankful for our guest today, Sabrina Singh, who lives with bipolar, and she's going to talk to us about her journey. A little bit about Sabrina. Sabrina holds a bachelor's degree in Asian American studies from Stony Brook University and a master's degree in South Asian religion and philosophy from Columbia University. She lives with bipolar disorder and shares her mental health journey as a way to support, advocate, and create awareness for mental health. She's a contributing author in anthology of Sikh love stories, Her Name is Kaur, and Brown Girl Magazine's first ever printed anthology, Untold. She's been featured on TV Asia's Shades of Shakti and has collaborated with organizations such as NAMI and the New York City Department of Mental Health and Hygiene for their Today I Thrive campaign. She's committed to using her experience with mental illness to eradicate the stigma surrounding mental health, especially in the South Asian community. We had a really good conversation. We talked about Sabrina's lived experience with bipolar, her story behind her diagnosis, how she's learned to navigate living with this condition over the years. And we also talked about misconceptions about bipolar, as well as different microaggressions that people often make, whether it's knowingly or unknowingly, toward people who have mental illnesses. If you've ever used words like the weather is so bipolar, I know I've been guilty of that myself in the past. And she shares her perspective on why that language can be harmful and how we can use language that is more inclusive and doesn't invalidate someone's lived experiences. I hope you guys find today's conversation to be informative and meaningful. Hi, Sabrina. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi. Really good to be here.
So we are here to talk about bipolar disorder. So you were diagnosed with this condition when you were 16. Before we dive into your background and your story, can you kind of just share with us what this condition looks like for someone, you know, in terms of the symptoms or episodes, and what would someone experience on a regular basis with bipolar disorder from like a medical perspective?
Okay, so I have bipolar 1 with psychotic features. And so everyone's experience, I know, is very different, but there are a couple of different types of mood disorders that are categorized under bipolar disorders. So it's like bipolar 1, bipolar 2, and then bipolar depression. So in my experience, bipolar 1 is the cycling of basically two primary moods, which would be mania and depressive episodes. They also can happen at the same time. So that'd be they coexist always. So that's like what we call mixed state. And basically when I say mania, it's a high. You're definitely feeling like you're on top of the world and you can do anything. I would never use the word happy. Because I don't think that it like is a time or state that like brings you any kind of joy. Mm-hmm. It's almost this feeling of exuberance that you can just like take on the world. A lot of like grandiose thinking, like I'm going to be president, or, you know, for me, I'd always be like writing a lot during that time and like working, you know, I'm writing 10 books or, you know, and it's that feeling of that you can do anything and you cannot stop. Like there's so much. Like typically when we say, oh, you have a lot of energy, it sounds positive, but there's so much energy built up in your body during a manic episode that you can't even sit still and you definitely can't sleep. So I mean, there are times that through mania, I would get no sleep for like 3 hours. And never, you know, when you don't get sleep, you'll like wake up and feel tired. You almost feel tired until like that point comes where you're just like burnt out.
And when you have these manic episodes, how long do they last? Is it like a couple hours or is it a couple days?
So that also varies depending on the kind of bipolar that you have. I have cycles that are pretty like regular throughout the year, kind of also around the weather. Like if it's cold out and the days are shorter, I'd probably struggle with depression, while like when it's warmer, that's when you'll feel where you feel like better. But sometimes it can be mixed in with some manic like feelings. There are people who have what's called rapid cycling, and that could mean they're going through these moods just in one day, by the hour, by a couple minutes. So it's constantly changing. For me, if I had to say, I probably had between like 6 and 8 weeks of each before like the next cycle comes. And you definitely feel it. And after keeping like a cycle journal or a mood journal, I've noticed that like during specific times during the year, that's where I can expect to be either manic or depressed. So it kind of hope ahead in that way. But I know in the beginning when I was diagnosed, I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know. I wasn't definitely keeping track on anything. I had no ability to do so.
Yeah. And so you mentioned manic. When you're on a manic high, you know, you feel like you're on top of the world, you feel like you can accomplish anything, but it doesn't necessarily correlate to a feeling of like good happiness.
No.
How does that impact, you know, your level of focus or like productivity in terms of doing things that you want to do?
Yeah. So I think that I always felt like, wow, I'm able to get more done. But I don't think it's actually getting more done. It's just me feeling like I'm doing a lot. It's almost not really happening. And that's definitely also changed a lot over time. I noticed like in the beginning, when I started seeing these things, it was like the thoughts in my head were racing through. And I really struggled at that time with like containing the thought and staying focused on like, what am I actually thinking? But also containing the energy. Like, I know I'd feel so worked up that I would just like feel the need that I need to run, like pace a lot or run through the house. Or we have a pool in my backyard, and so there's a deck that, you know, surrounds the pool, and I have like vivid memories of just like running around that deck like it was a track. Like I was a track star or something, which is really funny because I don't run ever in life. So
yeah,
I think what I struggle the most with when it comes to mania, even now that I know how to like handle it better, is the impulsiveness and the inability to make decisions and not knowing like how to say no or what you should do, you know, certain situations, which when you're younger, especially like newly diagnosed, you know, finishing out high school and starting college, that probably impacted me the most then.
So when you say impulsiveness, like you mean you've learned over the years to control your impulsiveness?
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Like I used to have a very bad relationship with shopping, like shop when sad, shop when happy. And it was just the need to feel like you're buying something, like getting excited for something. I mean, I could find something at like Men's Warehouse. Like, want this, you want to, I've noticed like the often, like the touch and the feeling of even having cash.
Yeah.
So like debit cards have been a game changer. It's really small things like that I noticed day to day, that years ago, it wouldn't have happened that way. It would have been totally different. And then because I struggle with psychosis a lot, when I manic, I'm like on these adventures and I think I'm like, it's like having the auditory and the visual hallucinations of like, oh, monkeys are flying in the room. I've never been in a room with a monkey. So I know that's like logically, I know that's not happening, but I think these thoughts just like got away, like someplace with my brain. It's like they run off.
Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned in our pre-chat that you also have or had a lot of suicidal ideation, and that is a symptom of your bipolar condition.
Yeah, 100%. That's a huge part. Honestly, that's the main reason I even wanted to see a therapist and get help, because it just, I had these thoughts and I was a super young teen, like 13, 14. And I really thought, okay, maybe this is normal. Maybe everyone thinks like this, or maybe it's a hormonal thing. You know, you're starting to go through puberty and there are body changes. So for a long time, I chalked it up to that. But then finally, it was consuming in a way that like I would go to the kitchen and just think of all the ways in this kitchen, like the tools I could use to hurt myself. And that never felt like anyone should feel like that. So that's it for me. And now I know, like, whether I'm depressed or I'm manic, I always struggle with ideation. I think a lot of people think it's like, oh, you're feeling sad. It's not always sadness.
Absolutely. Like when we think of people who have suicidal thoughts, we often associate that with, you know, unhappiness or a series of specific events in their life that have led this person to get to this place where they don't want to live anymore. Whereas for people with bipolar, like having those types of thoughts is like a physical symptom of the illness.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's become very regular for me. I just like never even imagined that there could be a way for me to live this bipolar life without ideations. I mean, there are certain times you have them under control and they're not so active and you're not, you know, making any actual plans, but a lot of the time it's very passive. And I think that's honestly just a reflection of how intense and consuming bipolar disorder can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know you kind of touched on when you were like a teenager and you started to have these thoughts, but tell us a little bit more about how you first discovered that you had bipolar. Like, tell us about your diagnosis and what led to that. Because I know there was like a few specific events around your 16th birthday that culminated to that diagnosis.
Yeah. So I started going to therapy when I was 14 because it was obvious to me and definitely the people around me that the things and the way I thought wasn't healthy. So I did that for a while and I kind of knew deep down that it wasn't helping. So I figured there had to be another solution, if there even was a solution, but I didn't know what that would be, mainly because I didn't know anything about mental health at all. I knew I saw a therapist. I didn't know what kind of therapist she was or what degree she had. I didn't know anything. So the idea of even going to a psychiatrist to get an evaluation was definitely confusing to me. And basically what happened is that my symptoms started manifesting in a very physical way. So I was feeling very sick. You know, this is common for a lot of people. They struggle with like stomach issues and feeling the need to throw up all the time and headache. So that was happening, but I was also in the process of planning my Sweet 16, which was like everything to me at that time. I mean, I had been planning for this since I was like 13. So I was really, while like coping with the anxiety and the mania, not really mania, I didn't know it was manic at the time. Now I can identify that as manic. So while coping through those symptoms, I was having the time of my life. Like I thought this is all I ever wanted. This is going to come. I'm going to be so happy. And I don't know what I thought or what kind of magic I thought happened when you're 16. But I don't know. One too many like Disney sitcom and rom-com movies, I thought it was going to be like everything. So my party happened and it really goes down as one of the best days of my life, 100%. I know the joy and the feeling that I felt like making my entrance. That feeling is I don't know if it can ever be matched. So it was great. And then my birthday's Labor Day weekend. So we had the weekend and we were still celebrating and things were really, I thought, were fantastic. And then it just all ended. And no one prepares you for how anticlimactic those things are, right? So it happened. And then, like, the weekend was over and I started junior year of high school just like that. And it almost felt that there was nothing to look forward to anymore, mm-hmm. or nothing good surrounding me. Maybe that's a better way to say it. So it's a quick slippery slope between mania and depression. You just, like, you don't even slide. You're like tumbling and rolling down as it's happening. And so I noticed, though, like, I saw those things happen. Like, I was feeling more sick. I started losing a lot of weight because I was depressed and I didn't want to eat and I didn't really want to do much of anything. And I think the depression was getting worse and worse on top with severe anxiety and paranoia, which is really the most destructible bipolar combination. And so I noticed I started having a lot of, like, little panic attacks or anxiety attacks, a lot of crying. And then one day in my high school cafeteria, I just, like, lost it. It was October, I think, you know, school was new and everyone is talking and, you know, like, people are in their own group and they're chit-chatting.
Yeah.
So it's like hearing all those noises, and then the voices in my head were just so loud, and something had to get canceled out. And I just stood up and started crying and walked away. Like, I just lost it. And I went straight to the nurse, and then, you know, they check your pulse rate and everything, and none of my stats were good. And my mom came and we went straight to the pediatrician. And she basically said, you need to have her see a psychiatrist. Like, she needs a real evaluation. I don't think therapy is enough mm-hmm. at this point. Like, you tried therapy. I tried therapy really for a while, like 2 years, maybe not consecutively, but, you know, during that time. And even then, when I think about it, and she was saying that, I was like, what does that mean? Like, what is this other doctor going to do? It didn't, I knew nothing. I don't even know at the time how I knew to ask for a therapist.
Right.
I don't think I had any concept of mental health or mental illness other than the, like, 45-minute conversation that we had one day in health class.
Right, yeah.
It was really scary. It was a really, really scary time, because it's not only your body failing you. It's like, this is my mind. Like, why can't I be in control of my thoughts? And really, what was also terrifying is that I know now to say those were voices in my head. But then it was hard for me to even detect, like, these are other voices. These are not me.
Mm-hmm. So prior to the actual formal diagnosis, like, when you would share with your parents that, you know, you were feeling a certain way or you're hearing these voices, did they believe you, or did they just kind of dismiss, you know, what you're saying as just being, like, dramatic?
So I think we had this journey. We had, like, started on this little path already, because when I was 14 and asked for therapy, they were extremely dismissive. And only as I, like, kept asking, and then my guidance counselor spoke to my mom, did we actually find a therapist and go. So I think all these other things happening were confusing, and they were definitely alarmed, especially by the weight. Because, I mean, I was really, really underweight, and I was taking, like, Boost and Ensure, and I was really trying, but it was nothing would ever stay down. So I think that was what made them realize, like, something else is happening here. But I think also at the same time, I don't think they even knew anything.
Right.
I don't know if they even knew someone that had gone to a psychiatrist or what a psychiatrist really did. And I know for sure none of us knew what was to come. Definitely thought it was going to be, you know, you have a cold and you take some cold medicine or Mucinex and then you're ready. So I think that was the hardest issue that we all struggled with. But also, I didn't share a lot. I didn't share a lot with anyone because it felt wrong. And it felt wrong to feel this way, and it felt wrong to share. And I was scared. because I didn't want to be called crazy, you know?
Right, yeah. And adult, I mean, when you're that young as a teenager, it's already such a confusing time.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, fit in and with my friends and, I don't know, take the SAT. It wasn't, I was never like thinking about it. And that's what I mean that it was consuming. It's that I was really working hard not to focus on my brain and what was going on in there, but I couldn't, and I didn't know how to express it. Like, now I have all these words that are part of my regular day-to-day vocabulary, and they have meaning to me, and they're defined in my life. But then, like, I'm saying paranoia. I don't think I knew that I was paranoid or that I was having panic attacks. I knew I was crying hysterically, and my chest, you know, was like, my heart was coming out of my chest.
Right.
But I didn't, and I'm saying voices, and I knew it wasn't only me, but I definitely didn't put more thought into it that it could have meant something or been something more than a passing thought.
Is there a cure for bipolar?
No, there is no cure for bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. They can give you medication to minimize the symptoms, and therapy is always very recommended to learn to cope and manage your emotions and your thoughts, and definitely learn to live within the cycles.
Mm-hmm. So right now you're on both therapy and you take medication.
Yeah. So currently I am in therapy, both individual and group therapy. I take medication, and I am also undergoing ECT treatment, electroconvulsive therapy, known as shock treatment. And that's very new for me.
Okay. And what does that entail? Do you have to go somewhere like inpatient, or is it outpatient?
Yeah, so it varies for person to person. I know some people have done this on an outpatient basis, and someone takes them and brings them back, and they just go, you know, once within whatever their expected time period is. But for me, unfortunately, I was not able to do it outpatient. So in the beginning of January, I was committed to an inpatient psych unit, and I was receiving ECT 3 times a week. And I did that for 3 months. And now I'm receiving treatment on, it's called maintenance. So it's like every 2 weeks, then every 3 weeks. And now I'm up to every month. So that's exciting because I can do that. I can do this from home now. But in the beginning, when it was 3 times a week, I just stayed in the hospital.
Okay. So you were inpatient for 3 months at a psych unit. So can you kind of just tell us what that experience is like being in an inpatient mental health facility? Because I think like what we see on TV, you know, makes it seem like there are these barren rooms or shackled to a bed with a straitjacket. Like, what is it actually like?
Yes. So now I'm counting. It was 64 days, so a little more than 2 months. So January, February, and March, but just, and you know, this wasn't my first time. I have been inpatient 10 times, I would say, about 10 times. And the first time, I remember being terrified for the exact reason that you just listed, because what you see on TV in any show is never what it's actually like. So the first couple times that I went inpatient, I actually stayed at a really beautiful facility that was not a traditional psych ward. It was actually a facility, and we were in cabins. It was very scenic, actually a really beautiful place, but there's no internet, there's no phones. There's a lot of rules with what you can have and what you can do, like clothing, no strings, no shoelaces. And these are really all for safety reasons, because where there's a will, there's a way. And majority of people that are inpatient, I would go to say majority of the people that I've met inpatient, they are there because of suicidal ideations. So it really is a lot of therapy groups, and they do manage your medication. you're typically in a room with another person, and you're living like you would at home, but you just don't have access,
right,
the way you do at home, right? There's no technology. There is a TV. They typically have like a TV room. There's not TVs in each room. And the bathrooms are locked and you have to ask someone to go or to get you don't keep any of the toiletries yourself. But it's definitely not at all how it's portrayed in the media. And if there's one thing I could really change, it would probably be that, because it's really scary to make that decision to admit yourself for inpatient psych treatment. Either you making the decision or it being involuntary, it's a scary experience regardless. So having all these thoughts and not knowing what to expect and thinking that, you know, you're going walking into like one flew over the cuckoo's nest it's more intimidating and it's more anxiety inducing.
Right.
This past time, though, I was at a medical hospital. So it was a psych ward, which is a little different because it's just one floor and all the same rules apply. But we actually didn't go outside at all. So for 64 days, I was inside on this one floor and you can barely see outside. There's like one window that you can actually see outside. And all the other windows are like fogged.
Mm-hmm.
So you never really know what's going out there. And it's amazing what happens when you don't breathe fresh air for 4 days. The biggest difference, though, at this unit, they had no phones, of course, but they did have computers with internet that it was like communal, right? Like you had a living room with a TV and they had two computers that you could log in and use for like 15 minutes. They also, and I think this is new because of COVID, but because the rules of visitation in these units, these places in general, any medical facility is changing all the time, they also had tablets that we were allowed to use with doctor orders.
Okay.
Then they would just tell you have like this amount of time. And it was really used to like FaceTime and call family because they couldn't come.
Okay. And do people make friends with each other? Like, is it a social kind of environment? Do they encourage socializing with other people?
Yeah. I think that's the biggest difference between going into a hospital for psych compared to when you go for any other medical condition. You would just have a room, you'd be in a bed, you'd be treated by the nurses, and you don't really have any interaction with the other patients. But the way these facilities and these units are set up is that you are interacting with them in different groups so that you can support each other and learn from each other's experiences. And they try to really diversify the activities that they have, like yoga in the morning or Tai Chi, and then groups to teach coping skills, and then groups to express yourself, like music therapy or art therapy. Pet therapy is a big favorite. You're doing this with other people who I want to say, quote, unquote, are like you. They're struggling in the same way, because even if they don't have the same diagnosis, and they're definitely no two people have the same shared experience, but there are these themes that kind of run through for all of us, you'll find.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people like me that I've been living with bipolar disorder for 20 years. And then there's someone coming in recently diagnosed. So you're constantly gaining so much from the peer experience. I've always really appreciated that, because I think for a long, long time, I always felt very alone in my thoughts and thought that I was the only one. It definitely felt that way when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And it always felt like I was the only one, that no one else had this, maybe because I didn't see other people. And
and no one's talking about it, especially back then.
Yeah, 100%. So like once I was diagnosed, this was 2006. I was a junior in high school. So my parents applied for disability accommodations through the school, mainly because going to school sometime was not possible. Like I didn't know how to cope or deal, and I couldn't I couldn't get it together. So I started missing a lot of school. And this accommodation, everyone gets like something different. I had a 504, really gave me some flexibility to like complete my work, still excel in school and meet my academic goals, but not put added pressure on myself to sit in school from 7:30 to 3 o'clock on a day that I couldn't stop crying or vomiting or whatever the case,
right,
the case was. Part of it, though, part of the accommodation, and this I'd always be so grateful for my school district for how they did this. I was put into a group and I started seeing the school social worker. And that was the first time I ever met other people that were struggling mentally, mm-hmm. not with bipolar disorder, but just struggling in any way.
Right.
And it was validating, I would say.
What was getting through college like? So you did your undergrad at Stony Brook University in New York, and then your master's program at Columbia University in New York. So that's, you know, no easy feat for anyone, let alone when you also have this mental condition. So what was, how did this disorder impact the demands of being a college student and graduate student?
Trial and error. And the reason I'm going to say that, and this is something I don't actually talk about often because I think there's a part of me that's still embarrassed for how it happened, but I went into college thinking that it was going to fix everything and that it somehow me having this independence and I was going to figure out who I was or what I wanted to study, that the expectations of being like a good Indian girl would be in my hands. And I don't know why I kept linking that and, you know, strict Indian parents with bipolar disorder. Maybe because I wanted to find a reason or justify it in some way. So when I went to Stony Brook, I decided that I wasn't going to take medication. And that was the worst decision I've ever made. And I'm saying this solely as my experience, because I know a lot of people live very productive, fulfilling bipolar lives without medication. But for me, it wasn't good. I had a very extended manic episode. And everything I had worked for was really falling apart because I couldn't keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
So after, I mean, colleges take this seriously. Like Stony Brook, first I was on probation and then you get the next semester because, I mean, I wasn't doing anything. I couldn't go to class. I couldn't figure it. I just, my brain had like gone. It had lost all reason, really. Like nothing made sense that was happening around me. So first it was the probation and then the second semester I again did not figure learn in any way, I guess. So you get that letter home of mm-hmm. like, you know, this is it for you.
Right.
And I was actually able to work with them and explain how medically this was affecting me. And I went back to the psychiatrist and got medication. I started seeing the psychiatrist at Stony Brook University so she could like help me manage on campus. So that was really helpful. Their disability program was also very helpful because being a disability student from high school and bringing that with me to college, I really, again, for like attendance accommodation or if you have a panic attack during a test, like you should get that chance again. Knowing that things are available to you, very, very helpful. And then the biggest game changer, and I will forever credit this program with everything I have been able to do, was joining an IOP, which is intensive outpatient program for therapy. And it was for DBT therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, which is actually very commonly used to treat borderline personality disorder. But they had found it to be very effective with bipolar disorder. So it was a 6-month program and I was going to school and taking meds and I didn't even drive at the time. My mom would really like come back and forth so I could go to my program the couple times a week I had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed my life because for the first time, I wasn't band-aiding every situation. It's like, this is going to happen. This is going to happen again because you do have bipolar disorder and it's never just going to magically go away. And this is how you cope with that. So DBT has four modules, I believe, that you learn within. And it's really just learning and practicing, trial and error, to find the skills and the tools that work for you. I think Selena Gomez talks about this a lot, actually. I know the therapy has become increasingly popular over the years since, you know, I went through it back in 2009. So for me, what's really been life-changing is distress tolerance, learning in any moment, any little thing that gets you upset, from the smallest things to the biggest things, how you can work through that in a healthy way. Certain skills and tips you use. Emotion regulation, because as someone living with bipolar, you have a lot of emotions.
Right.
Emotions, and sometimes they're happening at the same time. Even, and you don't know if you're going or coming. So how do you complete a paper when this is happening?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was another skill. And then grounding. DBT focuses a lot on mindfulness and like teaching your mind that we have logical thinking, we have irrational thinking, and then we have that in between, that middle path, which is called wise mind. And a lot of this comes from Buddhism. Ironically, actually, the founder of DBT is Marsha Linehan, and she was associated with Stony Brook University and founded this therapy many, many years ago. And it has been a true game changer, to the point that that was 2009, over a decade ago, and I'm still using these skills and tools. And any program that I have gone to moving forward has been a DBT program. The facility that I mentioned in Westchester, it's DBT based. So when you're going inpatient and you're working on medication management, or you're just there for safety, at least you can be surrounded by these skills and be learning from, you know, therapists and mental health workers around you.
Yeah. That's so wonderful that you found this treatment and learned how to cope with bipolar using this treatment. Do you know, like, how accessible is this program to people who have bipolar disorder?
Okay, so that's always the sad part of everything, and I always feel like I have to preface this when I mention it. Mental health care in any way is not very accessible. I mean, we know this is something we're talking about all the time, the need for it. Now, programs like DBT in particular are very costly, mainly because I think it takes a lot of training. For the social workers or psychologists, it's like they go to school and then they're taking these trainings as certifications added on. Also, another huge problem is that it's expensive and most of the time not covered by insurance, because unfortunately, most of top mental health care is not always covered. I was very lucky that these two hospitals were. The program was you know, it's on private pay. I know they probably work with you to some degree to, you know, finance it if need be. But unfortunately, I think that's just the state that we're in, that there's not a lot of accessibility to programs or treatments or therapy that's also affordable. So that's definitely a big issue. I know it's getting better. I do. I've definitely seen DBT be more mainstream now. Like my current therapist that I've been working with for maybe 15 years now, she specializes also in the DBT skills, so that we're working the program every day. And I use a lot of AA quotes because I think their recovery is applicable in any form.
Mm-hmm.
And they always say it works if you work it. So when you learn something, if you're constantly implementing it in your life, like I have an activity workbook I use and then I'm with her, then it becomes part of your everyday. You don't even need to think about it. It's to the point that like this happened, I'm upset, I'm automatically doing this. And it's like verbatim. It's just in your body. It happens organically.
Yeah. You have it like ingrained in your brain.
Yeah. And that's really the best way. I mean, they're great thing is there's tons of resources, right? With Amazon, there's everything. So you can find a therapy book specialized even in DBT to fit any diagnosis. Because the way I learned it to help me with bipolar disorder might be different for someone, you know, struggling with like PTSD.
Right. Yeah, it's just really unfortunate, like you said, that these programs and services that can be so effective and life-changing for people are also so expensive, such to a point that
many people can't comfortably afford this. Like, no. I don't know about DBT in particular, but a lot of these, you know, a lot of intensive mental treatment programs can be like $30,000 to $40,000. And, you know, we know how complicated insurance is in America, like, especially when it comes to mental health. And that's like a whole separate can of worms that we could probably do a separate podcast on. But it's like, it's unfortunate because it's, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's either you don't have a job, which I think would make you eligible for Medicare and perhaps therefore making that type of care more accessible. But like, then if you do have a job, then it's like, you're not. And, you know, for the average person in America, shelling out that much money just may not be possible without it completely undermining like the quality of your life.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I mean, it goes from the very beginning, actually, like even to get an official diagnosis and have an evaluation. It's so hard to find a psychiatrist on your plan that takes your insurance that sees you for more than 5 minutes, if they even see you at all. And the price that you pay private pay psychiatrists and providers for an evaluation, again, is not, it's not what everyone is capable of. It doesn't meet the masses. And I think that's the problem, because all around us, people are struggling with mental health. They are probably living with mental illnesses that they don't even know about, less yet can't even be treated because they can't get properly diagnosed. And I think I see that a lot, because bipolar disorder is probably one of the most overdiagnosed mental illnesses for like a variety, again, like you said, political insurance reasons. And it's really, really unfortunate, because until you really have a diagnosis that fits your symptoms, how do you even get the right treatment?
Mm-hmm. What does your day-to-day look like right now? Like, are you able to work?
I'm currently not working. No, I am not. So as I mentioned, I was in the hospital for 64 days and I was discharged March 23rd. On March 25th, I started my what's called a PHP. It's a partial hospitalization program that you go to 4 hours Monday through Friday as a step down, really, to work with you in adjusting back to your normal life, especially for people who have been in the hospital for an extended period of time. It's hard to just come home and go back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there from March 25th until May. And then straight from that, I was put into the IOP, which is, again, intensive outpatient program, where it's 3 times a week for three and a half hours instead. So I was there. I went from 3 days to 2 days, and I actually just finished last week.
Oh.
So this is my first week without all that, but I still have a very heavy treatment schedule. So I have individual therapy one day. I have group therapy another day. I actually go to a support group that I now facilitate. So that's
wonderful.
That's another group. And then there's still meeting with the psychiatrist. I am currently working with two psychiatrists, one that I've been seeing for a long time for medication management. She diagnosed me many years ago. And now I have an ECT psychiatrist, because not all psychiatrists really have the experience and the knowledge of working with these different kinds of alternative treatments separate from medication. So, and then add a day for ECT and basically there's it. So my whole life right now is treatment and working towards recovery so that I can work again and really finding a life and creating a life and finding a job and a career that fits in with my mental illness. I can't do it the other way around. I tried that and it doesn't work so well. So people talk about work-life balance. I need like work-treatment balance.
Yeah. What are some misconceptions that you want people to be aware about bipolar or mental illnesses in general?
I think really for me, the biggest one, it's like a huge pet peeve of mine when I first started sharing my story and people found out, the comments that I think they thought were really nice were kind of like loaded.
Yeah.
That's that if you have bipolar disorder, you are not as smart or intelligent or able to just function in the world. I think we always have to remind ourselves that there are different functioning levels, and no one wears their diagnosis on their sleeve or on their forehead because it's not who they are. Like, I have bipolar, yes, but it doesn't make up my everything. I mean, when I was working, and it was just my first job, and it was 2016, I believe. And so you don't have to disclose. So I did not. And they didn't Google me or know or anything. I know some jobs do that now, but they didn't know. And then I was offered the New York City Today I Thrive campaign with the Department of Mental Health and Hygiene. And part of that was a PSA. It was a commercial. And so it became known because people were seeing it. And my boss from work said, "Wow, I'm really so surprised that you have bipolar because you are really smart."
Mm.
And I was like, "That is so rude. What? I never saw like how are the two related?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, especially in other countries, when I was doing my field work, that bipolar has like a look that you're not as like composed and you're wearing super bright lipstick and like really over the top makeup and dress eccentric. And it's like, black feeds my soul. I am always, you know. And she was like, I mean, are you sure? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm 100% sure. But that's not what,
asking if you're sure if you have bipolar.
Yeah, was I sure if I had bipolar? This was actually meeting with a psychiatrist while I was doing my field work in Trinidad. Yeah, when I was doing those interviews, I didn't ever say, like, disclose, but something within the conversation made me say it. And she's like, "Really? Are you sure? Because mm-hmm. this is typically what we see." And I will give credit to part of that narrative. When you are manic, you are over the top, right? And this is what you wear, I guess. You know, I definitely know that. But even recently, I think it was Modern Love, the Amazon Prime show.
Mm-hmm.
Anne Hathaway was featured, and she was living with bipolar, as part of the story. And the way they portrayed mania, they made it a musical so that she was manic. So she was singing and dancing. And my mania has never looked like that. If it looked like that, that would be great. And I could be on Broadway and live out my dreams. But that's not that I honestly, the spin to that narrative is when I'm manic, I'm very, in particular, just me, I'm very paranoid. Mm-hmm. So I definitely don't want to go to the grocery store and sing and dance with the fruit. because I think everyone's following me or the right. fruit are attacking me. Like, so it's just interesting. I know other people have different experiences. There are people that really relish in mania, and I'm not saying this so that like, wow, being depressed is better, because neither is good. I dream of just one day of just waking up and having my mind just be like leveled.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be stability for me. I'm definitely getting closer to that with the help of ECT. It's definitely changed and helped me a lot, but so that is a big one. And then other people, and especially since I've started ECT, I'm seeing this mainly because I even bought this too. I thought like they put this thing on your head and they're going to electrocute you. And that's what it looks like in the movies. And it's not like that at all. And I think that's the scary part. It's like, oh my God, they're shocking your brain. They're electrocuting you. And once I was able to talk to the psychiatrist about these misunderstandings, I was like, okay, I can try this. Yeah, this could be good. But you almost, these narratives that the media or society has created, you have to like remove yourself completely.
Mm-hmm. It's just so important to remember that like mental illnesses aren't always obvious to people. You know, like you said, you don't wear it on your sleeve. So chances are who you think has a mental illness or who doesn't, you have no idea. Because like from the outside, you know, like none of your personality and like the way that you speak would make me think that you've struggled, you know, in the way that you have if it wasn't for you opening up about it.
Yeah, It's funny that you said that. So I think the next biggest, I mean, I probably have a list of issues that I have having lived experience for so long. But another big thing is when you're suicidal and you are searching for a will to live, but you're still able to get up and get dressed and go out or, you know, blow dry your hair because you have to blow dry your hair. Like, people are like, oh, well, I mean, if you did that, then of course you want to live, because people that don't do that, they want to live. And it's like, I'm telling you, I'm going to kill myself. And you're talking about makeup and blown out hair, or like, you took out your nice bag. What does that have to do? And I think that's the biggest problem for me, is that I've always presented a certain way and like worn that mask, and I created this facade in this world and this bubble.
Yeah.
So when I shared finally with people, like, I struggle a lot and, you know, I've been cutting or I want to kill myself, they don't understand because they, in their mind, they have this perception and this image of what that looks like.
Yeah. What are some microaggressions that people often use and don't realize are microaggressions against people who have bipolar? So, like, I think the common one that I can think of is, you know, oh, like, the weather is bipolar, which I know I've been guilty of myself, and I'm actively trying to avoid using those terms now. But talk to us a little bit about that, and how does that make you feel as a person who is bipolar when you hear other people use the term to, you know, describe the weather or these other trivial events?
So I think it's a Katy Perry song that's like, lovesick bipolar, something like that. Like, you're hot and you're cold. Like, you're hot and you're cold and you're up and you're down. So I remember that song coming out when I was probably a freshman or sophomore. And I remember thinking, like, what does that even mean? Like, bipolar is so much more than up and down or manic and depressive. And I think because you're literally saying bipolar, people can only think of like these all or none statements that are so polarizing in your brain. And I think it never really bothered me. And I'm okay, I am the queen. I make jokes all the time, but I don't make jokes to offend people or like take jabs at other people. It's honestly how I've coped through some of the really ridiculous things that have happened. You just, you know, you just live it as comedy the best you can. Like, you know, we're riding through life and we're just laughing our way because terrible stuff is always happening. So I know, and I'm saying this knowing that I make jokes. More recently now, I don't like, especially the weather comment.
Yeah.
Because we have a beautiful language, right? Any language that you speak, they're all so beautiful. And there's so many words and there's so many phrases and descriptions that you can use synonymously with what you're trying to say when you say bipolar. So I just don't understand why we can't do that.
Yeah.
That's one. And two, no one ever says like, oh, that's so cancer. That's so diabetes. So why is bipolar then used as an adjective? I am not bipolar. I have bipolar. I live with bipolar, but I am not, because it's not my ever being. So I'm just confused why it's like the one illness, one of maybe a couple that we use as a description word. Like with anxiety, no one says I am anxiety, or that's so anxiety.
Right.
So I think that really bothering me now. And I also think this is probably an unpopular opinion, but a lot of mental health and mental illness, these conversations, it's common and it's happening and it's part of our space. Now we're creating space for it, which is really phenomenal. But I almost think with the world of social media, it's become kind of clickbait. So everyone kind of wants to like be in the mix, which also, if that creates awareness, I'm all for it. Because if you're a top influencer and you're talking about how you take care of your mental health and how if you're feeling this way, you should call a hotline or you should reach out to people or see a doctor or see a therapist, I'm all for that, using your platform. to spread good messages.
Mm-hmm.
Great. But recently, I will not disclose who, big South Asian influencer, I guess she's like beauty fashion. You know, I've definitely heard her talk about mental health, like everyone does. But then it's a story and it's a video. It's like, oh my God, the weather's so bipolar today.
Mm.
So then let's talk. I don't think you can be both.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's virtue signaling.
Yeah, I think if you think mental health is important and you can acknowledge and support people who are really struggling with a severe mental illness like bipolar disorder, that can be removed from your vocabulary.
Yeah.
In fact, 10 other words for the weather. I will give one, erratic. Let everyone start. Let's use erratic.
Yeah. I mean, words matter. And if there are ways to adjust how we speak to help others feel safe, then it's worth being aware of and changing how we use those terms.
Yeah.
It's like I have a good friend of mine who's adopted, and she's actually been on the podcast before. But through our friendship, I've learned how, you know, when people jokingly say things like, oh, yeah, you're the adopted sibling, you know, that's a microaggression toward adopted people that makes them feel self-conscious or isolated, you know, or different.
It's invalidating. That's really what it is. It's invalidating.
Yeah.
To experience. She's had this experience. You know, I'm living this experience. And no, I don't feel like I can relate to the weather at any point. The day the weather comes to my support group, I will go with it. And, you know, the world moving that way. I mean, obviously I'm joking, but it's just, if we want to show support, like you said, and make our friends feel safe and let them know they are not alone and it's okay to talk about this, then we also have to decide how we want to take in that information, their knowledge that they've trusted you with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for so long, that's why people didn't say anything.
Right.
I mean, I was diagnosed in 2006. And I didn't share my story until 2014.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn to, I guess, accept and make peace with having bipolar? Because the way that you speak about it, you know, it sounds like you've really like come to terms with it. You know, you've made peace with it. So what was that journey for you accepting that this is like part of your reality and having that kind of outlook that you have today on it?
It's so funny that you say I accept.
or maybe you don't. I apologize.
Yeah. No, I talk a lot about acceptance because it's really important to heal and to be one. And, you even hear from the psychiatrist and the therapist, until you accept it, you really can't move forward. So it's only almost like an impediment from you and your next step to recovery or your journey. And what I've learned now is healing, like acceptance, is not linear. There are different things you can accept at different points in your life, right? In 2006, when I was diagnosed, I accepted nothing. I was like, this is not happening. Why is this happening to me? Why am I suffering? Why are other... It was always why. And there was no acceptance there. I was working towards acceptance. But then, you know, going off medication, you're not accepting anything if you're doing that. So I think most of Stony Brook, I struggled with acceptance, most of college. And like I accepted that I had this, but I didn't think it was bringing anything to me. I saw it as a weakness for a long time. You know, and then you hear things like, oh, who will marry her? She's like this, or who wants a sick girl? Those things don't help the journey to acceptance. And it was like that for a long time. I think the game changer for me is when I started writing about it. When I started writing about the experience and the diagnosis and how I was learning to be okay with it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the turning point for me. I had accepted the medication, though. I definitely had accepted I am going to be taking medication for the rest of my life. That is okay. That's like, that was my step one.
Mm-hmm.
And that when I started grad school and I began sharing my story on, you know, Brown Girl magazine, sharing my story gave me more than it could ever give anyone reading or anyone that I'd hoped to help. It gave me this sense of tenacity and courage, and it made me realize a lot of good qualities that I had developed as a result of having bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think I talked a lot about like bipolar and blessed, and that's when it was really a good time in my journey. I was forming a relationship with bipolar, and I think that's what I always needed. And I think it was for a little bit. When you have a rough episode, though, you are still going to lay in your bed crying of, why me? Mm-hmm. And this sucks. Because guess what? It does suck.
Yeah.
And then most recently, my acceptance, in 2018, when the doctors told me I was treatment resistant and I needed to try something else, I was like, no way. This is not happening. And for a while, I was like seeing different doctors and bipolar specialists and trying different medications and going off and trying holistic. I was doing everything the most. And then finally, I had to accept that it was not enough. Nothing I could have done was enough, and I needed that outside help. When I had my evaluation in November of 2021, and we talked about it with the psychiatrist, he specializes in not only ECT, but other treatments. And he said, I really think this is what you need to do, and this is going to be your next path to healing. For while I had to do like a medication detox, because there's certain medication you can't take through ECT. So I was going to therapy a lot and really working on like, this is really happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
There was no acceptance there.
Yeah.
There was frustration, disappointment, anger, sadness that I had to just like be the most like, why did I have to be treatment resistant? You know, a lot of other people, God bless them. They just like, you know, live their life. They take one pill a day. They go to therapy. Some people don't even take medicine and they do like homeopathic stuff. So the fact that I'm being told now that I had to shock my brain, that was another level of acceptance. And to be honest, the whole time that I was in the hospital from January 19th to March 23rd, I was not accepting of anything. I hated the whole situation because it's a lot to go through. And I was so frustrated that it wasn't working the way they said it was going to work. Maybe I might have told myself it was going to be like magic, and it's definitely not magic. And through partial and like IOP, now I'm accepting like ECT changed my life. It helped me a lot. If I had not done it and committed to it, I'd probably be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would have kept trying to kill myself. And now it's acceptance with gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I know that will forever. So it's really just you're constantly going through these ups and downs. Do I accept that I have it? Yes, I'm having it. I live with it. But do I like it or I love it? Not so much.
Yeah.
But I know I've said this like time and time again, that I hate the things living with bipolar has put me through, but I always love the person it made me become.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me a lot. It's still giving me a lot.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Last question. What are some ways in which people or family members or friends can support their loved ones who may have bipolar? Like if you had to give one piece of advice, what would that be?
In school, we learned silent and listen are spelled with the same letters.
Hmm.
And by school, I mean that was like a poster in my third grade classroom. And I've never forgotten it. And now more than ever does it ring true in my life. Be a good listener. And being a good listener does not mean you are an advice giver. Really, I do not want advice from anyone. No one, even other people living with bipolar disorder, can imagine what it is like to walk in anybody's shoes.
Yeah.
And until you've experienced that 100%, which we know is impossible, you can support, you can suggest, but never assume that because you don't have a mental illness, you know better. That's a big one. And don't assume because you might have struggled with like, oh, I had anxiety and I did this, that it works for everyone. Everyone's illness and everyone's experience, though might be same by the numbers in the DSM-5, are not, they're never going to be equal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important that we remember everyone is on a spectrum and there are different severities. So I think people think that when it's supporting, it's like, I don't know what to say. Don't say anything. Sometimes it's just nice to say, I am here. You are not alone. You are enough. That is a big one. There are lists online of affirmations and things you can say to a loved one suffering with any mental illness, just as a way to offer support and know how to show love. Yeah. I think that is a big one. And even asking questions. Did you take your medicine today? No, that's that. Unless you have a young child or a minor and you need to, check on that, by all means. But in a case where it's peer-to-peer or we're adults and you might see me a little sad, don't ask if I took my medicine. No, because it's okay to have a bad day. Bad days are normal. Even people without mood disorders have bad days.
Yeah.
And so that's a big one. I think for parents, especially, if you are a parent and you notice your child doesn't seem okay, ask, check with them. Make sure it is known that you care. Because in that moment and with that feeling, nobody cares. Nobody loves me. These are the very hurtful words and negative sayings that are like on repeat. I know it's not, it can't only be in my head.
Right.
So I think, and know that even though someone has a mental illness, even like bipolar disorder, which is not curable and will forever be there, that we are people too.
Mm-hmm.
We're human. And even though we have extra big feelings, we are not dramatic. Dramatic. No, we are not dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
I will forever say, probably this will be the last phrase on my deathbed, I am not a drama queen.
Yeah.
Do I over-exaggerate? Yes. But the emotions and the feelings that are going through me are very valid. And they are very much happening. It's not all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are these phrases that we've used for a long time that we need to just like wash away.
Yeah.
Just let it go, because it's 2022 and we can do better.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for those reminders, especially about the advice thing. Like, you know, I think it's so instinctual for us to feel like the other person is looking for us to give them advice. And that's just not the case. Like, sometimes just being silent and listening and just offering your support and letting the other person know that you're here for them is all that they need from you.
Yeah. And I think what comes from that is that we love people, especially parents. You love your kids. You don't want to see them hurt. So you want to problem solve.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. But the reality is there are some problems that can't be solved. They can only be like mitigated, if you will,
mm-hmm.
made a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, Sabrina, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and being open to talking about living with bipolar. I think especially in, you know, South Asian cultures, like speaking openly about mental health is just not as common. There's so much shame. There's so much stigma. And you being as open as you have been over the last few years, you know, one, allows other people who may be struggling to feel safe opening up about their own journey, and then also just creates more awareness for everyone else that this is real stuff that people go through, and, you know, the importance of building empathy and finding ways to be a support system. One last thing, how can people connect with you or get in touch with you?
So the best way is always on social media. Follow my Instagram. I'm sure Julie will be putting in the hashtag here. So it's at Sabrina K. Singh. I'm hoping that this is a good year, and I would love to continue working on some of these projects and maybe start a blog. and have a space where, you know, we can connect in a greater way, especially through writing. So hoping that big things are coming, but always feel free to reach out on Instagram. I do write a lot about mental health and all things mental health, self-love, and just this journey we call life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Sabrina.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review. You can also connect with us on Instagram at @thebrowngirl_podcast and all other social media platforms listed in the show notes. Thank you again. I appreciate you being here.